Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are, the last song. And I pray that after the music stops, that the focus will be on you, Lord. People will see you for who you are and worship you with their lives. Cam, share your heart with us.
El Shaddai, God, you're almighty. God, you're almighty. And Father, I worship you. El Shaddai, God, you're almighty. God, you're almighty. And Father, I worship you. I worship you, yes. Father, I worship you. Lord, I worship you. I worship you. Jehovah Nissi.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Lord, you're my banner.
Hello?
Lord, yes, you're my banner. And Father, I worship
hello?
You. Jehovah Nissi. Lord, you're my banner. Lord, you're my banner, and Father, I worship you, I worship you, Father, I worship you, Jesus, I worship you. Jehovah Jireh, you're my provider. You're my provider. And Father, I worship you. Jehovah Jireh, Lord, you're my provider. Lord, you're my provider, and Father, I worship you. Jesus, I worship you. Jesus, I worship you. Lord, I worship you. Jesus, I worship you.
Yes, sir.
Miss Gidget for
else? The Gidget not there? Let me try her again. Let me see if I can get her. She was on the phone line, but I'm looking at her right now, and I must have dropped her call. Let me get her back on right quick, and we'll get this thing started. Hey, Bro Raheem, you can go ahead and get it started right quick.
Yes, yes, yes. Ladies and gentlemen out there in Radio Land, Internet Radio Land, this is Nation Building Blog Talk Radio Show, and you're listening to your brother Rakim Khalik Muhammad. We got Sister Marilyn, the co-founder of Nation Building. We also have Sister Gidget, and we got DJ Black Caesar, our engineer and co-host as well. What we got going? What's that?
That's Gidget's number. I'm calling her back.
Sister Gidget, Sister Gidget.
You've reached 832. 887-9306.
We can't hear a number.
Not available to take your call at this time.
Oh, wow.
Just leave me a message. I will return your call as soon.
Oh, no.
We're going to try her back in just a moment. Let's try Brother Jason. Jason, are you there?
Yes, sir, brother. How's Brother DJ?
How you doing, brother?
How's Caesar doing tonight?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. How about yourself, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank God. It's good to hear everybody's voice. Well, Rakim, shout out. What's going on, my brother?
Brother J is bang glorious. My brother, how you doing, brother?
I'm fine, fine. Thank God. Thank Allah much. We're going to have a wonderful evening tonight.
Yes, sir. Brother, I thank you so much for coming aboard and, you know, volunteering to do this. I mean, if you didn't volunteer, you were asked, and brother, you jump right on it. And we definitely appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. And I, you know, always love the Nation Builders and the effort that we're putting down. We're putting it down tonight. And last week, I understand we had a wonderful turnout. And Brother Rakim, you're definitely doing it, building our nation. And I
you
thank
preach
you for that.
832?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Brother, you know, so I'm not doing it alone, brother. I got Sister Marilyn. I got Sister Gidget, I got you, I got Brother Derek, I got Sister Jacqueline, I got Sister Yvette, I got DJ Black Caesar, I got, the list just goes on and on. Brother Jason, I got Brother Jamil. I mean, I just can't thank Allah enough for the whole Nation Building family. We got Sister Precise Wisdom.
Sister Gidget,
we have Sister Michelle Muhammad. We got Sister Michelle X. I mean, we got so many brothers and sisters that are down with this movement, and I thank Allah for each and every one. Without you all, this would not be possible. Brother Jason.
I don't know if he's still there. Brother Jason, Brother Jason, are you still there?
I don't hear him, brother.
Let me try his number again, man. Let me see if I think we dropped the call. Let me check right quick. I'm going to call Sister Gidget first, and let's see if we can get her on the line.
Sound like my big sister walking in the rain. cold in hand with somebody, she'll never be the same.
Sister Gidget, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now, man. What's going on with you? What's going on, sister?
Listen. You know the show is on black-on-black crime, sister. We can't have you on, you know, dropping phone calls and loading your clip up.
Hey, Brother Jason on the phone?
I'm calling him right back right now.
All right. Come on, because we got people waiting to call.
Yeah, I'm calling. His phone call was blocked.
Oh, there's a storm. It's a storm here and in New York.
Yes, oh, this is Jason. I'm on the line.
Brother Jason. Brother,
yes, sir.
Brother Jay is back in the house, ladies and gentlemen. Brother Jay, Vainglorious. We about to start this show off talking about black-on-black crime and what we can do to solve the issues. I mean, to solve the problem, which is, it's making us become, as black men, endangered species. We're already endangered species. And you got to ask yourself, how the hell are we the majority? And don't never let the white man fool you or lie to you and say we're the minority. Hell, we the majority. How the hell can we be the majority and be an endangered species? Well, that's what the topic tonight is going to be about, and what we can do as a family, as a nation, to encounter these problems.
All right, Brother Rakiki.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, let's take it to the stage. We're going to take it in a little bit of different direction.
Sister, hey, listen, you got the book, queen. I'm just here to serve you. You the queen.
Well, no. We're all brothers and sisters in faith and in love and in community and in kind. And hopefully by the end of the show, in spirit. I wanted you to save what you were saying for the show. When it comes to solutions, Brother Jason is going to enlighten us to some of the history. So if you don't mind, allow me to introduce Brother Jason. But since you've already spoken, that is Brother Rakim Khalik Muhammad, who is the founder and chief executive officer, and he's our king of nation building. And I can't thank Allah enough for all your work, Brother Rakim, and your vision. And thank you for allowing me sharing your vision and coming in and make my noise and do what you do. I couldn't do this without you. So, brother, all praise is due to Allah for you, and I thank you so much. And I know I've gotten so many text messages and so many inbox messages. I don't want to keep the audience waiting, but I do want to take time to introduce Brother Jason to... Can everybody hear me?
I can hear you, sis.
Brother Caesar, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. I hear you loud and clear.
Brother Rakim, where are you?
Brother Rakim, are you still there?
Yes.
I'm here.
Right. I got my phone on mute. I'm trying to make sure y'all don't hear none of this noise I'm around.
Right. Here. All right. I want to take this time to introduce to you Brother Jason X. Alori. Brother Jason is from Queens, New York. He is a former first officer of the New York Mosque. He is a trainer in the New York Mosque as a present, and he works with the Fruit of Islam directors. He is also known on the East Coast as MCJX. That's another life, but I understand he is well-versed in his music, and hopefully one day soon he'll be able to share that entity of himself with us. But also whispers in the wind that Brother Jason is a community activist, and he's a married man, and he has a 18-year-old son. But more than that, Brother Jason is a live organ donor. And I want to give Brother Jason an opportunity to share with us that story, if you would, Brother Jason.
Well, getting all things in the name of Allah, we thank Nation Builders for this opportunity. And we'd like to thank and show a deep respect for the audience. audience, those who come to listen to what we have to present this evening. And we thank you from wherever you came from. There are many different perspectives and different people that come looking for solutions. And Sister Gidget and Nation Builders, Brother Rakim, Brother DJ Caesar, all of us are looking for solutions to the same problem. And one of the things that I've recognized in my time and my sojourn is that love is at the center of everything that we do, and it's the greatest force known. I just want to say, in terms of the organ donation that I made in 2005 to our beloved brother, a brother of ours by the name of Brother Kenneth Muhammad, he's living out in Atlanta, Georgia now. But it was love that was at the center of the donation, what happened was brother took ill, and during that time I told him when I came to visit him in the hospital that if it was anything that I could humanly possibly do for him, that I would. And at that time we found out that his kidneys were failing, and when your kidneys fail, not one of them fails, but they generally fail together. So it came to pass that brother was going to need a transplant or be subject to dialysis like so many of our people. Make a long story short, we went and got tested, and as it turns out, I was a 2-antigen match to brother, so we were able to take the time, do all the required and requisite tests that were necessary to make sure that the donation would be successful, and I was able to donate my kidney to brother, and at this point, he's living well. By God's grace, he's productive inside of the mosque and in the community. Brother is a well-accomplished tailor, and many of the bow ties that you see brothers wear, they come from brother's bow tie factory, and he's just an all-around decent brother. And what I would like to say with regard to that is brother Kenneth is a very humble man. He would have never asked me to donate anything, not even $2, let alone my kidney. And all during and throughout the sojourn, he was asking me if it was too much. And I told him no, that he's a brother of mine. And it's not that he was an official. He was somebody that name ring bells in the nation or name ring bells in the street. He was a brother and is a brother. And that was the basis of why I decided I was going to give him my kidney. It's not those that's always in high places. It's those sometimes that's in the lowliest of places that are in need. And if those of us that see them in need and have the ability to give, you know, we have a saying that if you got a bowl of bean soup, half of that bean soup belongs to your brother. And I take that to heart. And we were able to successfully do that, Sister Gidget. And it, to this day, is a success in my opinion. If my brother could have lived one day without having to go on dialysis, I would have measured his success. But this is, you know, here we are 6-7 years into it, and brother's still doing well with my kidney. All praises due to Allah. But, you know, to turn the page on this, I don't like to talk about myself at all. It is very uncomfortable for me to talk about myself. So I would like to turn it over to you, Sister Gidget, and ask you what made you come up with the title of tonight's radio program, Cain and Abel, the first recorded murder known to man. What made you come up with that idea, Sister?
As you may have know, I was really advocating for justice during the Trayvon Martin situation, which is still going on, and I kind of put up a Facebook hoodie campaign, and I really started to review statistics of murders of black men just through the years, just, you know, through our historical time on this earth. I'm not one to really study stats because of the uncertainty, but what has been recorded, even if it's half of what has been documented, that is staggering. But I also just kind of recalled how often I would hear about young black men being killed in various situations. And it was disturbing to me when I read the statistics that I think it was in 2010 that 49.6% of the murders that occurred in the U.S. in 2010 were murders of black males. Now, that's not including those that are under cold case files or those that they can't determine a cause of death, nor does it include those that are missing. What was even more so disturbing is that 93.7% of those men were killed by other black men. And so I started to check myself, so to speak, with my outrage at George Zimmerman, of course, who is the person who is being charged with the murder of Trayvon Martin. And I was like, all of this outcry behind this murder, but when it's really right down the street and next door and within our families, you know, we don't march, we don't protest, we don't, you know, call a press conference or anything of that nature. And I'm a mother of two sons, and I'm a grandmother. And if we do not turn this around in this day, our future is not going to exist. Our young men are dying at an astronomical rate. They are being incarcerated at a higher rate than they're dying. And so that speaks to a plan that was, of course, designed. Phone.
I just believe that was somebody calling in. You were saying that that was a plan that was designed.
Yes. Yes, sir. And I think without the realization of that, Brother Jason, our people are going to be in peril. And so I'm just really trying to, number one, get the attention of elders, get the attention of those in the community that are willing to be proactive and go out there and reach our young men and turn this situation around.
Now, you were saying that this is a Cain and Abel type scenario. What in your studies made you go to Cain and Abel when this came up in your mind, sister?
I just tried to figure out how did we get here. So I started thinking about murder in general. And so Cain and Abel being the first recorded murder of brother to brother really stuck with me because I was trying to fathom having that kind of jealousy or having that kind of envy or that kind of hatred for one that I am not just but biologically linked with. And it's disturbing how we have a lack of love for it. So I was going to go to the beginning, the historical facts of how did we get to where we are now.
Yes, ma'am. You still there?
Sorry. Excuse me, Brother Tech. I'm sorry. Caesar.
Yes, ma'am.
Can we detect where that noise is coming from?
Hold on 1 second. Let me see. Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Oh, that's you. Okay.
You what?
No, I heard it when you talked, but that's okay. It's better. Thank you. I'm sorry, Brother Jason. Yes, sir. Go ahead. I can hear you better now.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to make sure because, you know, we have many people that are calling in that are listening to Blog Talk Radio tonight. And to find out that you brought it back to the scriptures of the Bible to as a guide on mine. I'm going to read a brief portion in Genesis 4 regarding Cain and Abel. Now, you know, like I know, that it's not only Muslims that are listening to this broadcast. And so I would like to read, if you don't mind, from Genesis 4 in our Bible, the story of Cain and Abel. And then, if you don't mind, after that, I'd like to take it to the Holy Quran because those books complement one another as we're taught. So I'm going to start out Genesis 4, and I'll be brief. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. Later she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked with the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought the fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, you will not be accepted. But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching in your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? I don't know, he replied. Am I my brother's keeper? The Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crop. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. I'm going to leave it right there in the Bible. I'm going to pick it up in the Holy Quran. The fifth story entitled The Fool, and it's under the portion Cain and Abel, and it goes in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, and the Merciful. Murder is stopped against the prophet. Ayah number 27. We're hearing a lot of sound in the background, baby. Please.
Hello?
Yes, we're having a lot of background noise. I can hardly hear myself.
Yeah, I hear it too. Can you please mute your phone? Mute your phone if you're not speaking right now. Mute your phones out. Better mute your phone. Except for the people speaking.
Don't worry, I'm going to be brief on the scriptural reading, so if that's what's making people nervous, it's not going to be a full scriptural night. I just wanted to get this out there as the foundation for our talk tonight. And so,
yeah, but I hear you, Brother Jason, but there's somebody moving around or moving some things. If you're on the Bluetooth, we can hear all your sounds. We're asking that you mute your phones or that you take your phone off.
I'm here.
Do you see any people you have live on the phone?
I'm trying to find that person, but I'm not having any luck right now. Give me a second, we'll find him.
That was probably it right there. All right, that sounds like that's it, right? We're good?
Okay, I think that was 347.
Okay, I'm sorry
okay,
about
family.
That, brother.
Well, I'm going to pick it up in section 5 of The Fool. Cain and Abel, murderous plots against the prophet. I'll be brief.
Hey, Brother Jason, your phone is kind of deplete now, man. Can you move around a little bit and see if that's you?
Hold on 1 second, brother.
Okay.
Is that any better?
Yeah, that's a little better.
All right, then. So we're going to start section 5 under Cain and Abel. This is the fifth surah of the Fool. Starts with ayah 27. And relate to them with truth the story of the two sons of Adam, when they offered an offering, but it was accepted from one and was not accepted from the other. He said, I will certainly kill thee. Others said, Allah accepts only from the dutiful. And thou stretch out thy hand against me to kill me, I shall not stretch out my hand against thee to kill thee. Surely I fear Allah, the Lord of the world. I would rather that thou shouldest bear the sin against me in thine own sin. Thus thou wouldest be of the companions of the fire, and that is the recompense of the just. At length his mind made it easy for him to kill his brother. So he killed him, so he became one of the losers. Then Allah sent a crow scratching in the ground to show him how to cover the dead body of his brother. He said, Woe is me. I am not able to do this as a crow and cover the dead body of my brother. So he became of those who regret. For this reason, we prescribe for the children of Israel that whoever kills a person, unless it be for manslaughter or the mischief in the land, it is as though he had killed all men. And whoever saves a life, it is as though he has saved the lives of all men. And certainly our messengers came to them with clear arguments, but even after that, many of them commit excesses in the land. And I'm going to leave it right there, Sister Gibbons. So
yes.
Just to show that both the books complement one another, and there should be unity in those who read the book based on that. So I just wanted to get back right into where we were with the stories of Cain and Abel and how they basically manifest today. Because we know that the things that we read of the scriptures of the past are mostly allegorical to what's going on today. It basically, if it is not going to have any bearing in our lives today, then why are we even reading?
Exactly. And it seems as though it's a description of our roadmap to our present situation as salvation or our way to salvation. It's become a harsh reality, that story of Cain and Abel, and it's not just tied to a biological family member. It is also tied to us as a human family, and it is very that, you know, in this day and time, all that we have been through in this country and dealing with this society, that we have turned an evil heart on each other.
That's right. Now, I know, Sister Gidget, just like me and most of the listeners to Blog Talk Radio Show tonight, many of us have personal stories that we can relate to exactly what we're talking about, that we'll take it out of the abstract and put it into the right here and right now. Would you like to share a story regarding this? Because I definitely have one as well.
I have so many, but I think out of all of them, the one that still stays with me is the murder of Patrick Chapman, who was a good friend of mine, who was killed in 1986 because he shortchanged a friend who had sent him to the store. He had shortchanged him by 25 cents.
Hold on, did you say 25 cents?
25 cents.
Okay.
And argument ensued over him being short 25 cents, and him, what dealing with that was to take a 12-gauge shotgun and shoot 19-year-old Patrick Chapman in the chest.
My God.
And that has always stayed with me because that young man in particular had so much promise in his life, and it was just such what is so even more I can't even describe it. It's just even more senseless was that when it was all said and done, he wasn't even short 25 cents. And here is a whole life and a whole future gone for nothing. And that's always stayed with me. It shook me to my core that someone could be so cruel over money and over such a minute amount of money. You know, it was just senseless. And we have so many stories like that. We have some that die for less than that, Brother Jason.
Yes,
brothers and sisters being killed for the colors that they wear or the neighborhood they come from or, you know, the color of their skin. You're too light, you're too bright, you're too dark, you're too black. All kinds of senseless reasons.
Yes, ma'am. I would like to share, for 20 years, I did what's called field service rep work for Medicaid. Here in New York, that's the city-run health insurance. And what I did was I worked for a private company that did hospital Medicaid, and what they asked me to do was to go into our neighborhoods once people had been in the hospital already and a bill occurred from their time in the hospital. It was my job to go to their home and apply them for Medicaid. Once the Medicaid application was set, the hospital would get paid their money. The person would have ongoing Medicaid, and then the company I worked for would get 10% of the prospective bill. So I did a lot of work. And I worked through the time of the crack era in our community in New York. And during that time, as you know, there was a lot of flossing going on. Brothers had... And people live in ways where I was going to visit them. Now I'm a working man. I'm working, 40, 45 hours a week. And I would go to homes in the projects that were like palaces. There would be a project apartment, but inside it was, at that time, the big screen TVs and the leather sofas and living in such a way that it was like a palace inside the project. And you knew what was going on. And a lot of the people that I would visit would not be the actual person who had acquired the hospital bill, but would be a relative because the person that was actually the holder of the bill was deceased. And I remember sitting in the kitchen with a mother of one of her sons who had passed away. He had been shot at the corner store. Guy shot him from the head to the stomach 5 times. I'm sitting in the kitchen with her, and we're doing the Medicaid application for one of her deceased sons. And through the door, another one of her sons and his friends come into the apartment. They say, "Hi, Mom," with respect. They look at me wondering who I am and what I'm doing there, and they head on to the back of the apartment. As they're going to the back of the apartment, the mother excuses herself and says, "Wait a minute. Y'all know y'all not going to the back of the apartment with all of that iron." And one by one, each one of those brothers came to the kitchen and disarmed themselves. And by the time they went to the back room, it was about 6 guns on the kitchen table. And this is just for them to go in and out of the neighborhood. And it stayed with me because it was right there, and I'm looking in the faces of these young men, and they reminded me of a military battalion or a military brigade, just young soldiers, warriors that had been in the street. They were probably looking for the one who perpetrated the murder that I was doing the Medicaid application for.
life was like.
Wow. Wow. I can't imagine children even feeling that they have to arm themselves just to walk down the street.
And sister, you know, I know a little something about guns. And the pistols that they put on that table, they were not little cheap pistols. These are, I mean, they were weapons. And they had to come from somewhere to get it right into the projects of Brooklyn. One of the things that I do know, sis,
yes, sir,
that our history here in America, as you said and as you started, where it became real to you in the beginning with the Trayvon Martin case, one of the things that I always respected about the nation is the fact that just like in the times of Marcus Garvey, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Minister Farrakhan, they remind us of our responsibility to our people in such a way that, as you know, Minister Farrakhan went on a Stop the Killing tour throughout our neighborhood. So he always had and has a love for our people when he admonishes us. I mean, he talks hard to us. I'm not going to say he doesn't tell us, you know, what we look like and hold a mirror to our face when he's admonishing us. But one of the things that I can't stand, sister, is people like, for example, Bill Cosby, who will be saying the same things in essence that our minister says, or the same things in essence that Marcus Garvey said, but his tone is such a tone that it's as though he has no love for us. Bill Cosby will say, well, it's all our fault, without recognizing the historical significance of how we got here, why we got here, and even would not turn the page like you did to the Bible or to the Quran to see the historical significance of why and how we got into this situation. And I don't have a lot of respect for people like Bill Cosby when he goes and speaks to us, down talks us, and makes us seem as though we're.
Yes, sir.
In the first place. So I just wanted to put that out there. And I'm getting a little emotional about that because I know that we are good people. We are basically the people of God. And to see that sometimes people that look like us do not have the common decency to even see that is going through a problem and a change, that bothers me.
Yes, sir. I want to tell you this, Brother Jason, because I can feel your passion, so to speak, on that issue. But let me say this to you, and I hope it'll be a word of comfort to you. Oftentimes, I know you've heard that many are called and few are chosen. A lot of us have been blessed to have a platform. However, when we do not understand who we are in totality and how we are connected to God, the Creator, and we don't see the God in us, then it's hard to deliver the same love and the same passion that Minister Farrakhan does for our people. You will hear a lot of that. You will see a lot of finger pointing and a lot of name shaming and blaming, but it's going to take love, and it's going to take that stern love, and it's going to take us being proactive in showing that love in our communities to turn this around. So I can't thank a lot enough for Minister Farrakhan, all that he has done in his servitude to the nation. He is our brother. He's our leader, our teacher, our guide. And there have been many, but there's only been one Farrakhan. So
that's right.
Just be blessed. Let us be blessed and rejoice that we are in his time and that we have been able to bear witness to all of the things that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad talks will come to pass. I'm fortunate enough to have been in the nation long enough to know and have met the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and a very humble and very sweet man, even though I was a very little girl when I saw him.
Yes, ma'am.
Never forget that meeting, ever. I think I was 4 years old. So there's a difference between having a psychological knowledge or a clinical training of the mind versus having the pure and unconditional love of God within. There is a difference. So even though Bill Cosby might have a degree in psychology, sometimes it doesn't always work. You can't be clinical about everything. Sometimes all the time, you got to put God in it.
You're absolutely right, sis. And I know that, you know, with all due respect to all those that are listening today, this evening, all of those that are listening, we thank you, and we have the greatest admiration and respect for everyone who is listening to this program. Why do I say that? Because you are the ones that are interested enough to tune in to a radio, a blog talk radio station. You know there are many other things that are going on to distract us from this issue. But this is the thing that gets to me, Sister Gidget. It's almost as though we're preaching to the choir. Because chances are, let's say out of all of those that are listening to the program this evening, maybe 1 or 2% are the ones that are actually perpetrating the type of violence that we're talking about. And the reason why I say that I have all due respect for those that are listening, because they know that chances are they're not going to commit these type of crimes, senseless crimes. But they also are more likely working towards, like we are working towards, solving the problem of this senseless, uncontrollable violence that we find in our community. So I'd like to commend all of those who are listening who are absolutely interested in this. You know, there was an article that was written in El Diario, which is one of our Latin papers here in New York. And the article was written by a brother, and I call him a brother, he's Latino, by the name of Herson Forero. And the way that he spoke about the epidemic of violence in our community, and, of course, when he says our community, he includes black and Latino because we are the same people. And I hate to even have to make that type of distinction here, but sometimes we get it twisted and think that when we're speaking of black or original people, that our original Latino brothers and sisters are not included. So the way that Herson Borrero put it is that this is a public health crisis that is in any way the type of murder or the death toll that was accrued. Let's say it was from a product or a pharmaceutical product of some sort that everyone in the entire United States and maybe the world, based on the startling numbers that we got in front of us, that we have in front of us, those numbers alone would make it a public health crisis. But many times, our own leadership, our black and our Hispanic or Latino leadership, looks at it as though, well, it's just those black kids killing one another. But it's a public health crisis, Sister Gidget. What do you have to say about that?
Well, Brother Jason, I don't know if I have anything to say about that, except for that is actual fact. It is a public health crisis. What I am more concerned about is where does it come from? How did we arrive to this level of self-hate, self-dissatisfaction, make us turn on what has happened to the pride and the dignity and the love and the respect that the African American, Latino, Native American, Oriental communities once had for one another. What's happened to the people of color in general? But what's happened to the black community in particular? Because I am not going to turn a blind eye to the political aspects that's taking place within our communities that have created such situations. But we have the ultimate responsibility here. We want to make it right. We got to first figure out how we got here so that when we see it again, we won't venture down that path. Because we have coming after us. And so how are we going to teach this chaos and to avoid the numbers of statistics of black men being killed in the future if they don't know how we got to this condition? But right now, I want people to understand, because when we go out there and try to reach our young men in particular and our young people in the community, we need to be able to explain to them what it is they're facing. But if we are turning a blind eye and if we're hitting our knees every night and say, well, God got it, and we're praying and we're not being proactive, making our prayers coming to fruition, then we're still going to have this problem 20 years from now. My grandson will be on Blog Talk Radio or Space Radio or whatever it's going to be talking about this same issue, which will make me feel as though I did not do what I could do in my time to make his future better. So we have a responsibility here to review our history so that we can teach our children how not to venture down the path, and let's deal with the reality of the obstacles that really stand in our way. And that's really our people turning the mirror on self, letting a lot of things go, letting Jim Crow go, letting Willie Lynch die, and let's be the kings and queens and the men and women of God that we were intended to be. But we have to know. We got here.
Yes, ma'am.
Jason, Brother Caesar, can we take a break right now? Because it's almost time for us to take a call.
Yeah, okay. Let's take a break right now and go to a song. This song right here is Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit.
Strange Fruit, yeah. An old classic.
Swinging in the southern breeze. from the poplar tree.
Was inspired to sing that song back in the 1920s when she found a young man in the South hanging from a tree. And lynching was the highest crime against black people at that time. But now it seems that it's done. But still, there's a strange fruit that dies in the street every day, and that's our young black men, because that's not something that's supposed to take place. Now, I know we've been on the air probably about an hour. Brother Caesar, do we have anybody with a question before Brother Jason and I proceed?
Yes, 347 area code, 347 area code. Go ahead and speak.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, brother.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we can hear you, Bob.
That's wonderful. How's everyone?
Hi.
Good night, brother. How are
you? Hi, everyone. My name is Efron, brother. They call me the street educator. I have the opportunity to be able to work in with my people, more important than anything else in this world, to be able to make this a better world for us. I enjoy the topic. I enjoy the points that the brother was bringing out all the way from before Garvey, after Garvey, and to the essence of what Elijah, Prophet Muhammad, and all has done for us. I'm happy with that. And it brings tears to the eyes of a conscious-minded man when you can hear the realities of exactly what we're being exposed to. And how is it possible that another generation of us can be so strongly dehumanized to the point where they just don't even humanly care about what's going on? So when you really get a chance to be able to get further into it, you'll get to see that's all I live for, that's all I stay focused on, and I'm proud of those of you that are conscious enough, human enough, and blessed enough to be on that battlefield with me, fighting for the betterment of a better life for the next generation. Again, my name is Efron, Efron Cherry. I'm the street activist, street educator is what they call me, and my goal is to be able to do what should have been done from the very first time that you took care of your offspring, feed them psychologically better, feed them psychologically more so that they could be able to do what is needed to be done. Unfortunately, a great number of us has felt through our jobs, so we have the most vulnerable, gullible mind of people that you've ever seen.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Brother Efron. Brother Efron Cherry from New York.
Yes, I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
Brother Efron, I would definitely like for us to connect. I would like to leave you with my email address, and I'm going going to come and see you in Brooklyn, brother.
That sounds wonderful, brother. We'll have an opportunity for us to be able
to
meet up with one another. I'm sorry, my phone keeps breaking up. Say that again.
I said, do you have the ability to take my email address right now? I'm serious. We're going to meet.
I have.
All right, then. Terrell. H-E-R-I-L.
I'm sorry. Like I said, brother, your phone is breaking up. Can you give me that number again?
Okay. It's Terrell. H-E-R-I-L. Number 7. At hotmail.com, and we're going to meet because there's a couple of events that we're about to have that I would like for you to be there. You're a street educator. You know the streets. You know Brooklyn, and we're going to connect.
Well, that sounds real good, brother. Again, like I said, and my work, a great number of people will get a chance to be able to see it as well. My work says anytime you want to recognize or strengthen me, go to the mirror. For whatever I'm doing today, imagine what I'll be doing tomorrow with you beside me.
That's beautiful, bro.
Antoine, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from Brother Antoine next week, as he's going to be a special guest on the show. So thank you so much for calling in.
Definitely, sister. I really appreciate each and every one of you. To me, each and every one of you that I've been listening to, it is ever so beautifully a blessed opportunity to say that none of what those great minds of us are in vain. It makes me feel good as a man, and I'm happy to see that, brother, like I said, I heard the readings, and I heard the brother when he was breaking down from the Quran all the way down to the biblical contents of what the Bible had to say. That makes me happy, and only because I need a great number of people to please understand me. Only because I am not some psychotic, sick-minded person that believes this disillusioned concept of religion places you in power because of what you read. That is not me. I am the mind of a man that understands that all these biblical contents are psychological ways of being able to enhance your intellectual ability to say what you will make of this world. Cain and Abel, they had a dispute in their mind. There was only one of them that was very comfortably proud in the mind of which that is for the betterment of life is, and that with the corrupt state of mind is that take the life of his own brothers. So when I hear that, my brother's keeper, I can hear it, and I take pride in being able to say, again, like I said, the battlefield, I have those of them that are intelligent enough to understand it, not afraid to be able to bring it out and to speak the truth, what's really, really going on. So that makes me happy.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, brother.
Thank each and every one of you. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I have another caller that has a question, but he doesn't have a phone number, area code. It's not showing up. Caller, you can go ahead and speak now.
Are you there?
Hello.
I have a caller.
Hello?
Yes, we hear you, sister.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I greet my nation building family and the greeting words of peace to Assalamu Alaikum. I'd like to thank you. My name is Sister Michelle. I'm out of San Diego. And I'm so appreciative for this program right here, because this, for me, really touches home. Because my son was killed at the young age of 15 by another 15-year-old. And it wasn't someone that he did not know. It's someone that he sat right next to in class. See, we never know how our lives are going to, you know, cross with one another. You know, I never would have thought that that particular young man was even capable of murder, let alone murder my son. So I'm very appreciative for any time we have the opportunity to talk about this violence is going on out here, and to try to find a solution for it. The thing about when my son died, he died in the last week of November, and for the rest of the year, that December, another one young black male died each week in December.
Ever so
wow.
True, sister. My heart and soul goes out to you.
Thank you, sir. You know, so I'm concerned, you know, and the only peace of mind that I have, you know, and they call Islam a religion, and you can call it whatever that you want to call it. But for me, it's a way of life. And these teachings that have been presented to me after I lost my son, I bear witness that they are the truth. I bear witness that they saved my life. I would not be here today because the killing of my son was the killing of me. And I will never, ever, as long as I live, be the same again. But I strive each day because I seek refuge in Allah. You got to have something that's bigger than you to be able to hold on to. So for me, this thing that's going on in the street, this young people killing young people, or just black people just killing black people, I think it's like anything left unattended will grow. See, too many times I've been out there in the streets and I hear, well, back in the day, we didn't kill one another. We fought it out and went home. But this is what happens. When you introduce any violence into the society, you do not know how that violence will grow. It's just like if you put a gun in someone's head, you don't know what that person is going to do with the gun. Yeah, you taught them not to kill someone. You taught them to, you know, put whatever that little safety lock on it and stuff. But you don't know. You know, that's why in the nation we're not even allowed to carry a little pen knife. You know, so I think it comes from being on the plantation under master's control that taught us how to kill one another. So we must educate our people on our history because it's a mentality that was instilled in our people to hate one another. And over this 400 and some years, that we have grown, it has grown into an epidemic of self-hate. And one who hates himself will not and cannot love another human being. So it's coming from self-hate. I don't know the statistic on the Jewish people, but I do know that they teach their children their history. And that you cannot close their mouths on their Holocaust. But every day our mouths are being closed on our history. We don't want to hear it anymore. They don't want to teach it in school, and we're told to get over it. But we were oppressed people, and now this oppression is coming out in a way that we're attacking one another.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
But, Sister Michelle, you know,
I'm sorry, Sister Gitsy. Go right ahead, Sister.
No, I just wanted to tell her we have to get back to parenting. And you know, I'm not speaking about anyone in particular, but we have to get back to parenting. There is a big difference between letting a child grow up and raising a child. When you let them grow up, you don't know what they're growing into. But when you raise a child, when you invest that time in a child, when you instill that discipline in a child, those morals and those values, and when those morals and values are coming from you and not from MTV and not from BET and not from Nickelodeon, there's a difference. We have to get back to the family. We have
ma'am.
To do that. And if we don't do that, then everything that they are exposed to becomes the strongest influence in their lives, and we lose ground as parents. So if you're not the strongest influence in your child's life, I suggest anybody who's listening to me to become that influence. Because the things that they're putting out here that our children are exposed to are leading them down the path of destruction.
Yes, ma'am, for sure. May I interject here? I raised 7 children on my own, and 3 of them were young men, and none of them chose to join a gang. And I asked my daughter, because it was gang members who killed my son. It was 5 young men that jumped and beat my son, and they stood him up, one on each side, and then the third one shot him in the chest. And he died from a single bullet wound to the heart, well, right near the heart area. And so I asked my daughter, well, why didn't his name was Mikey. Why didn't Mikey join a gang? And why did my other sons join a gang? And she said, Mama, because gangs are what attract people. Those young men come from lots of times from broken homes, they're not getting what they need at home. Now, not all of them, because some of them had very good homes and still chose the wrong way. But Mikey had everything he needed within inside his family that he didn't have to go out. So it is in your parenting. I lived in a big apartment complex, and I was taught that there's an element out there that's waiting to devour your children. So you have to watch them. So my children played right outside my window. They weren't allowed to go any place without me being with them. I don't care where it was. I went to school with them. So I tried to be a good parent and set a good example. You have to be in your children's life. And even though they might slip up to a house and watch and play violent video games and stuff, if you have laid a good foundation, they're not quick to give in to peer pressure and the other things that's going on around them. They can withstand it because you cannot keep violence away from them. But you can prepare them that when the violence comes to them, when they see it on TV, they don't have to mimic that.
Yes, ma'am, absolutely.
Yes, ma'am. I would like to extend my condolences to you, Sister Michelle, and
Thank you, sir.
Community of San Diego. See, because one of the things that we're failing to recognize is that a trauma to one is a trauma to all. Many times in our own lives, we suffer, and we do what? We suffer in silence. Sometimes if you just reach the hand out to the person next to you, and it sounds may sound corny, but sometimes if you ask someone, you feel their spirit is heavy. You may not know them, but ask them, is everything all right? That may be enough to de-escalate a possible situation where violence would occur. They have a thing that's called fight or flight that is in every animal. And when a situation comes up, and Minister Farrakhan writes about it in the study guide, about how the hypothalamus is excited and certain hormones are thrust through the body that it slows or makes your breathing more rapid. It makes your eyesight more keen. These things are throwbacks from a time in which we were hunter-gatherers. And that same trauma that is felt in one is felt throughout the entire community. And just as you, Sister Michelle, suffered a loss, and it's a loss over here, and a loss over here, and a loss over here, all of us are suffering in silence. And one of the things that I did learn about the transition that was made in South Africa is they had a thing called truth and reconciliation. The entire South African family was under the trauma of the Boers for all of the time that they was there. Okay, the influence of the white race on the South African people is still felt today, but not in the same way that we here in America feel the influence of white society on us. Why? Because when Nelson Mandela came into power, he had a thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. He allowed everyone who was under trauma on both sides of the equation to go to court, to take it out into the public and declare this is what happened. And one of the problems about America is she suffers from amnesia. Nothing that was done to us, if you bring it out in polite conversation or even impolite conversation, anything that was done to us is mainly shut down or swept underneath the rug. And just like Sister Michelle and Brother Efron was able to bear witness to the things that are going on in and around them, I feel this. It's not something that is just, okay, another one. I feel this. This is one of the things that I think is kind of, it's unique, but it's also inside of all of us is the ability to have a little bit of empathy. I feel the pain. When it happens to you, it happens to me. It happens to my family. It may not touch me directly, but I feel it. And I can say it in truth. And until America gets that same prick in her conscience where we can talk about the trauma that happened to the so-called Indians that are part of our family here. When Columbus and them came over and killed an entire nation of people, anytime I put my feet in the earth, I feel the trauma of the blood of the red man.
Come on.
Violence
mm-hmm.
begets violence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, Sister Michelle, I know you have been a long-time advocate of this, and, of course, Sister, my heart is with you on your loss because I know that you still are grieving for your son. So I pray that Allah will comfort you, and I pray that you will continue to inform and educate the youth in your community and other parents about being proactive in saving our children. So, Sister Michelle, I really do appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Yes,
and,
ma'am.
I appreciate you not keeping it up under the rug, Sister, keeping it, you know, up in our face. So thank you so much.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I appreciate this. This time, because, you know, I have often been told that I need to get over it. But this is not something that you get over, you know. Allah, to me, does not even expect you to get over it. He helps you to live through it. Because once you get over it, you tend to forget. And that's our problem. We forget where we came from, you know. The one thing I have constantly said is the young man, his name was Deron. Deron did not wake up one morning and say, I'm going to kill somebody, let alone I'm going to kill little Mikey, the little boy with the Betty Boo watch and the Scooby-Doo backpack. He was a 6-foot-old child, you know. That didn't just happen. Things happened along the way that led to that moment. That's what we got to get at. It's like the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, in order to cure the problem, we must go to the root to see what is really going on. And shows like this can get us to the root. So I appreciate this time, and may Allah bless each and every one of you. And I leave you as I came before you in the greeting words of peace. Of assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
Thank you.
What I want to say, Sister Gidget.
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry about that. What I want to say is a lot of people don't many people know Brother Rakim Khalid Muhammad, but a lot of people don't know that at August 4th, 1994, I lost my baby brother to a senseless murder. He was carjacked and killed by another brother, and I believe it was a gang initiation. So what Sister Michelle said, it hit. I mean, the whole subject that we're discussing, it hits close to home with me also. I grew up in Mississippi, partially grew up in Chicago, half and half, shall I say. I had the best of both worlds, the city, down south and up north. And
yes, sir.
I saw the mentality of the black men down south was the same as the mentality up north. I mean, Chicago, we had the Vice Lord, we had the BGDs, we had the Latin Kings and various other gangs, and they were killing each other like crazy in Chicago, but we had the same problem in Mississippi. So I remember when I was growing up, you know, your parents, a parent don't completely know their child. They can say, oh, my baby won't do this, my baby won't do that, but they really don't know what their baby would do. When I was growing up, I lived in a gang-infested area where I was no part of the gang at first. I used to run from vice lords and run from black gangster disciples every day, fearing for my life, because I was not part of a gang. So it came to a point in time in my life where I had enough. I joined a gang to get protection from another gang. It sounds crazy, but I had no backing in my neighborhood. So I had no choice but to join a gang. So for somebody to tell you that you don't have to join a gang, well, that's easier said than done depending on where you live at. I don't see a kid from the suburbs coming to the city joining no gang because in the suburbs, he's not exposed to gang violence and killing. But he has no reason to join, you know, he has no reason to join a gang. But a kid like myself, they grew up in gang-infested areas where there were killings every day. And those who were neutral were always caught up in violence because they were always trying to initiate somebody. They always tried to get you to walk the line. If you didn't walk the line, you met death or you got beat up real bad. I mean, that's what I grew up with. So I had to join whatever gang that was in whatever neighborhood that my mother moved in. If I moved to a BGD, Black Gangsta Disciple neighborhood, I had to become BGD. I moved in a Vice Lord neighborhood, I had to become a Vice Lord. I mean, that's just the way it was.
Wow.
So the best thing for a, I'm going to tell you all a funny story. True story. There was this little sister. She wasn't a little sister. She was probably like 6'3". I was sixth grade. She was about 6'3". She was a Vice Lord queen. And during this time, I was not part of a gang. She called herself Like Me. I did not like her. She was the biggest thing in the school. She was taller than the teachers. I mean, tall. And this sister, she kind of reminded me of you, Sister Gidget. She had this. She knew who she was for being in the gang. I mean, she was very outspoken, and the teacher was scared of her. I don't know if teacher was scared of you, Sister Gidget, but the teacher was scared of this sister. But she was outspoken. That's what I meant, Sister Gidget. She was very outspoken. She spoke her mind. And people were scared of that because white teachers were not, they never were prepared for a black child with a brilliant mind to speak their mind.
Right.
And this sister's energy was put into street gangs and violence. So she wanted me to be her boyfriend. I didn't want to be her boyfriend. She was tall and ugly to me. So what happened was she told me, she said, I'm going to get you after school. Now, mind you, I rode a bus to school every day. And I lived in a gang-infested neighborhood. Well, one day, this sister chased me to the bus because I wouldn't be her boyfriend. I missed the bus, but somehow I beat the bus home. I ran through yards and ran from dogs, running from her and everything, and I beat the bus home.
Wow.
What I'm saying to anybody who says that it's easy for a child to say no to a gang, it's not easy for a child to say no to a gang. But it is easier for adults, like Brother Jason said earlier, when Bill Cosby beats down on black men, we already don't love ourselves. We have a self-hatred. So when you beat down on a young black man, all you're doing is making him hate himself even more. And the more he hates himself, he wants to kill anyone or anything that looks like himself.
Yes, sir.
Exactly.
So therefore, you never should beat down, and parents, if you're listening, even though it seems like gang violence has stopped in some areas, gang violence is very real. Right now, gang violence has turned into drugs. I mean, they're more concentrated on drug territory. So therefore, you got the Crips and the Bloods, and you got the Vice Lords and Black Gangster Disciples, Lank King. Everybody seemed to be in peace and seemed to be getting together, but the only relationship they have with one another is drugs. If it wasn't for the drug supply and the territory and the money they were making and the material things that they were gaining, they would not be friends. So never fool yourself like gang violence to stop. It stopped because drug activity is at its finest right about now. So therefore, it appears that our neighborhood is in peace, but they're not in peace. You see a Vice Lord and a Black Gangster Cypher riding in the car together. You say, "Oh, that's wonderful. They done made up. They acting like brothers again." Damn. That could not be the farthest from the truth. When you see a Vice Lord and a Black Gangster Cypher or a Crip and a Blood together, they're chasing that almighty dollar. And we were always taught to hating ourselves and love white people. So guess what? We're chasing the almighty dollar, and guess who's on that almighty dollar? It's that cracker, the same racist white man that taught us to hate ourselves. We love him even when he's dead, and we spend in little green paperback bills with this, with some of the same forefathers who put us in this condition on the front of these bills. Meaning, no matter if this white man's living or dead, still loving him and hating ourselves. So what we should do, we should, instead of beating down on our young black men, what we should do, we should educate them on who they are. They don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. So therefore, I'm not going to take up too much time on the panel, but I just want to express that the solution is history. We need to learn who we are, where we come from, and the parents need teaching. We can't just teach the young men. We got to teach the parents. The parents are miseducated. They don't know what the hell is going on. They know something is wrong. They know they're losing their babies in the streets every day to gangs and violence. But they do not know how to deal with the problem properly because they themselves are miseducated. So we must start first with the parents. The mother's the first teacher. The mother's the first guard that a black baby see coming out the womb. And the father is the second. So we must educate parents so the parents can educate the children. That's all I got to say.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And we're going to go to a song right now. I think this song right here will bring it out pretty good, what we got on tonight. What's Going On by Marvin Gaye.
Yeah. No, they don't really want to take his cool off.
Boy, so I
just press it. Early in the morning, whiskey on my mind.
Wow, that wasn't What's Going On. I didn't download it. Yeah, check this out right here. This is Praying for You. This is Praying for You.
Father God, I'm praying to you for somebody who knows you, Lord, but just hasn't been seeing you in the right view lately.
Father, I'm praying for a friend. He and I are pretty close. And out of all my friends, but this one I'm concerned the most. He say he reading daily, but he ain't really learning. He been in church, but say that he ain't moved by any sermon. His face weak, he ain't prayed in a week. He wake up and just weep with his face in a sink. Lord, you gotta help my man. I'm praying for him daily. He ain't sin, but it just seems as if he going crazy. He say he feeling trapped, can't even hit up the mall. Cause every lady's half dressed, tempting him to lust and fall. He keep the TV off, videos just make him feel that he ain't really nothing without money, girls, and shiny wheels. The other day he told me that he felt less a man cause he ain't have a 5-year plan or a piece of land. And man, it's crazy cause his family thinks so much of him. Plus he got a godly wife who always show a love for him. But he's struggling, even though he talks to me. I tell him what to do, but he don't listen when he ought to be. I'm scared for him cause there's people that look up to him. He got some younger siblings who've been changed by what he's done for them. But is it done for him? Lord, don't let it be. If he don't want to talk to you, then Father, hear from me. Is it done for him? Lord, don't let it be. If he don't want to talk to you, then Father, hear from me.
We was last conversing. I'm with him now, he ain't doing well, but I'm certain. He say he's trying to trust you, doesn't want to disgust you. But he was in the midst of sinners and did not discuss you. And just today, his anxiety's got the best of him. He knows Christ, but for hours refused to rest in him. He's not the best of men, but Lord, I know he really loves you. And I can't understand why lately he's not thinking of you. People trust this dude, you can crush this dude. Father, he needs more of you, I pray you touch this dude. What can I say to him? I'm determined to pray for him. Father, empty and break him, I pray you'll just have your way with him. Cause there's a change in him. effects are strong. I pray he'll open up his heart before the next song. And when he gets home, I pray he'll open up the 66 book love letter you wrote and soak it up. Cause he ain't hearing you, and he ain't feeling me. And God, I know it's killing you, because it's killing me. And matter of fact, there's something else he's concealing, see. The person that I've been praying about is really me.
Praying for you, praying for you. Hey, guys, go ahead and take it away, guys.
All right, y'all. I wanted to take it to Brother Jason. And Brother Jason, if you would, I wanted you to share with us something that you shared with me from a sister by the name of Michelle Alexander and her book called The New Jim Crow. Can you express to us some excerpts from that book and how it is compatible to what our young people are facing today?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Sister Gibson. And again, Brother Rakim, thank you for that. As you were speaking, my mind was going towards Sister Michelle Alexander's book because of some of the things that you were saying in your own sojourn in dealing with the gang and dealing with the violence in your community, Brother Rakim, as a young man. Sister Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, was saying how this was set in motion for us. As we know, the prison industrial complex, as it's been called, has taken off since 1970. And there's a new information that has just come out. I'm not sure if any of us have been paying attention to this thing called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a group of high moneyed people, large corporations that funnel money into one, they call it a 501c3 or a public charity. But that charity's job is to actually write legislation that, and then bring in politicians and office holders and give them this legislation to introduce. One of the things as a young member of Congress or a young member of the House of Representatives, one of the things that you want to be able to do is to show your constituents that you have the ability to write legislation that again turns into laws. Then you go back to your district and say, see, I made this law, see, I made that law, see, I made the third law. But many of them, meaning the legislators, have to spend an inordinate amount of time raising money for their next election, and that's how they stay in power. So what this place, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, does is they basically do all of the work for them. But the legislation that they're writing always seems to benefit the corporation. In many of our communities, some of the legislation that ALEC has written goes like this: private, for-profit prison. Get into a community. They take the taxpayers' money to run these prisons by saying there's a certain segment of your population, namely black and Latino men, who are prone to violence, and the only way that you're going to keep a safe community is by allowing us to lock these men up. So they change the laws to benefit that paradigm. Inside of that, part of the cruelty in it is the fact that they have to, in order to keep the money flowing, they have to maintain a certain level of prison population for X amount of years. So consequently, not only have we seen longer sentences for the same crime, but we've seen much more aggressive police our neighborhoods. Why our neighborhoods? Why? Because we are the least politically active, and it's what they call low-hanging fruit. Nobody's going to say anything about another black or Hispanic or Native American man getting locked up because we have no power. So part of the unholy alliance is the corporations, the legislators, and this group out. It's proven. This is not something that's conjecture. So Michelle Alexander, in her book, talks about how this prison industrial complex feeds itself. And we, as the public, we just say, okay, I don't want criminals around me, so whatever they say goes. And the idea is very simple. Keep the black man down. Makes it very plain. Once we have our first brush with the law, many of our rights are taken away, and we become not second class, but second caste citizens. And the things that the old days Jim Crow used to legislate, saying that a black man couldn't vote, well, they can't say that in polite conversation today. So what does it say? A criminal cannot vote. A black man can't have a license. Yesterday, under Jim Crow, well, today, if you've been a criminal, certain licenses you can't hold. In certain communities, you can't even get a barber's license once you've been inside of the prison industrial complex. When you come out, what do you say? Well, I need to find employment. Well, when you go to check off on that box on the employment application, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Well, you have to check that box off, and many of us feel so ashamed if we don't check that box off. We're sitting at our desk once we got the job, and the human resources officer comes to our desk and say, pack up your stuff. Why? It's found out that we ran your history and you have a criminal past. You no longer have a job. Okay, I don't have a job. I can't get a job. All right, certain places in public housing, if you've had a run-in with the law, you can't be in public housing. Well, my wife and my children live in public housing. Well, if they're about to keep that low-priced house or a low-priced apartment, you can't live with them. Well, what do you mean? I just got out of prison. My family is here. Where do I live? I don't care where you live. You got to live where you can find a place to stay, but you can't stay in public housing because we have a strict policy, no formerly incarcerated people. So it makes you, as a person that has been involved in the criminal justice system, it makes you a second-class citizen. You can't find a job, don't have a place to live. What is the next move? Right back to prison. And then they mark us by saying the recidivism rates among black, Latino, Native American are higher than normal. Why? Because we don't have the infrastructure set up yet to take those brothers who come out of prison and say, I have a place for you. I know. I understand. I love you, brother. It's okay that you have had a criminal past. So have I. Many of us have been locked up. I know and understand what you're going through, and we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that you have a place to stay, food to eat on a regular basis, and employment so you can get back with your family. Maybe you work hard enough, you can get your business up, and you can move your family out of public housing, and now you can put your family back together. Sister Michelle Alexander's book, and she also goes on tour. She's speaking now throughout the country. I suggest if we can find out where she's speaking or get her book, The New Jim Crow. Sister Gidget, I know that was a very long-winded encapsulation of the book, but I'm just putting it out there to try to whet everyone's appetite to read the book and get from it what you can, because it is a protection for our young brothers and sometimes our older brothers who are now being released. They're formerly incarcerated, and they are wearing a great deal of shame on their back. One of the things that I would like to say to any of us who have family members that are about to leave prison and the prison industrial complex, don't ever let them feel ashamed. Damn it. One of the things that they say is, once you've been in prison, you've paid what? Your debt to society. So why, after you've been released, are you still carrying the burden of shame for your debt? Sister Gidget, I could go on all night. I'm just going to give it back to you, but that's Sister Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
All right. Thank you for that, Brother Jason. that is so true of how we've been set up. So, Brother Jason, in your opinion, what has been the root cause of the self-satisfaction and the self-hate and the lack of self-respect that has caused our young black men to turn on themselves and in acting out, so to speak, for lack of a better phrase, acting out that dissatisfaction by killing those that look like them?
I'll say this, Sister Gidget, and I would like to say, you know, all praises due to Allah for the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Minister Farrakhan for giving us the ability to go back to our books. We've been given lessons. We've been given the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We've been given lectures by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. All of those things are pointing for us to be a little bit more scholarly in our approach to our teaching. And I say that to say what? I'm going to turn it back over to another sister's book by the name of sister. She's a Dr. Joy DeGruy. She used to go by the name of Joy DeGruy Leary, but, you know, she got divorced, and she's going by the name of Dr. Joy DeGruy. And she has a book out called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And it explains and pathologizes some of the same behaviors that we are exhibiting in the streets. One of the things that we know about, if you've been in war, if you're a man that's been in Vietnam, and I have some friends that have been in Vietnam, you come back from Gulf War I, Gulf War II, back from Afghanistan, one of the things that we know is these brothers and soldiers are suffering from what they call post-traumatic stress. And post-traumatic stress is a real thing. It's living under the threat of death and harm and bodily harm for an extended period of time. You can't sleep. You're wondering when the enemy is going to rush you, yada, yada, yada. What it breaks down to is we as a people have been under stress and under stressful conditions, and we're suffering and we have been suffering from the same effect. And Sister Joy DeGruy makes her thesis as the post-traumatic slave syndrome. It's a result of a 12-year quantitative and qualitative research, and it's developed a theory, and she published her findings in a book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, and it's called, subtitled, America's Enduring Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. Post-traumatic slave syndrome is a theory that explains the etiology of the adaptive survival behaviors in African-American communities throughout the U.S. and its diaspora. It's a condition that exists as a consequence of multi-generational oppression of African-Americans and their descendants. It results from centuries of chattel slavery and a form of slavery which was predicated by the belief that African-Americans were inherently and genetically inferior to whites. This was then followed by institutional racism, which continues to perpetuate the same injury. There's a multi-generational trauma, this together with continued oppression. Then you have the absence of opportunity to heal or access the benefits available in the society. And that leads to post-traumatic slave syndrome. What happened is, from the time that we've been forced in slavery, no one has ever said, you people now have the ability to decompress. You now have the ability to go back to some of your original thinking. You have the ability to now reformulate family bonds. You have the ability to now educate and heal yourself. We've been blessed by the coming of Master Farad Muhammad to now see the diagnosis and the healing. And much of it is what you see today in our church families, our mosque families, our Hebrew Israelite brothers who have their temple families, that we now are able to feed one another gently back to our original state. But the trauma still remains. And just like when our sister Michelle was talking about a past history is not inside of us. And unless we get an opportunity to decompress, these things are going to foster themselves multi-generationally. What am I talking about? You know, for example, at one time, there was cocaine inside of Coca-Cola. When the Coca-Cola company originally produced the soft drink Coca-Cola, it had real live cocaine in it, and it got a lot of people hooked on Coca-Cola. All right, they knew that they were not going to be able to sell cocaine in its soda form for long, so once the government cracked down and they removed the cocaine addiction was inside of the great-grandmother. So when they produced the cocaine in its powdered form, in its crack form, we were already predisposed to the desire for cocaine through our grandmother and great-grandmother's womb. So all of the same traumas that we felt through slavery, I mean, some of the most heinous acts that were passed on. There's a book by a sister by the name of Harriet Washington. It's called Medical Apartheid, where she lists how some of these great doctors that they have statues for, and they write them up in medical journals, that those same doctors were the same like Mengele during the time of Nazi Germany, where they practiced their craft, and I don't even want to call it a craft, they practiced their abomination on black women. They were slaves. There's a gynecologist that is the most famous gynecologist who used to practice hysterectomies on slave women that were his slaves without anesthesia. He was able to do this because during the time, white women would not even let a white man look under their dress, let alone perform surgery. But these surgeries that had to be performed in order, I think one of them is a hysterectomy, another one is other female medical problems that he was able to solve. But look how he did it. He used slave women without anesthesia to practice his medicine. He gets written up in the journals, and then by the time they put it in the journal, it's no longer a slave woman. It's a photo, not a photograph, but a drawing of a white woman that's down. And so these women that suffered this trauma, nobody ever gets a chance to say anything to them. But if they produce children, their children are born with that trauma, and their children's children are born with that trauma, and they never get a chance to decompress to forgive it. So this is trauma that we have suffered as a people is still heavy on us, and we act out in ways that we see today. There's a thing called vacant esteem. With insufficient development of what the Greek refers to as a primary esteem, along with feelings of hopelessness, depression, and general self-destructive outlook, there's another thing called marked propensity for anger and violence. Extreme feelings of suspicion, perceived negative motivations of others, violence against self, property, and others, including the members of one's own group, for example, friends, relatives, or acquaintances. Sister Michelle, that was what was being acted out in the murder of your son. Racist socialization and internalized racism, learned helplessness, literacy deprivation, distorted self-concept, antipathy or aversion for the following: the members of one's own identified cultural ethnic group, the mores and customs associated with one's own identified cultural ethnic heritage, and the physical characteristics of one's own identified cultural or ethnic group. We hate ourselves. Why do we hate ourselves? Because there was a prolonged and a lasting hatred of us by a powerful entity that we felt powerless against. That was the long and short of it. The oppression of us has turned inward.
Okay, Brother Jason, also, I think you need to check your headphone. You're going out on it.
Oh, I took the headphone off. I'm sorry. It must be the cellular phone. I'm so sorry if those could not hear me. I apologize for that.
We can hear you. We can hear you. We thank you for that.
Well, there's some required reading. Just to get it. I just wanted to bring it to you now and ask you, because I know this is part one, and I know part two that we're going to have next week is going to be very lively and full. And I know you have some homework for those that are on the line before we hang up that you want them to bring to the next installment of this, because there's plenty more information to share. So could you please bring that to us, Sister Gidget?
Oh, no. I'm not the one with the homework assignment, Brother Jason. That's you.
Oh, come on now. Sister Gidget, I know that there are things that, as you envisioned Cain and Abel, that there were some things that you knew that this was going to be a part two to. And in the part two, you knew that you wanted to draw our brothers and sisters who are listening on this radio broadcast. You wanted to draw them in, and throughout the week, they were going to gather information and bring it back to us for this for next week's installment.
Right. Well, personally, Brother Jason, what I wanted people to do, I think it was a little bit different than what you initially told me. What I really wanted people to do was really look in their communities, and I wanted them to come back and share with us solutions, because we can talk this thing to death. However, many people are holding forums and talk shows and conference calls about this issue. I want to bring solutions, and then I want to hear in the future how they have put these solutions in action in their communities, within their families, or wherever, you know, it's feasible for them to do so. That's the homework assignment I would assign. I want people to call me in. We're going to be on the panel, but I want to hear from the listening audience. We're going to share information, and we want to hear solutions, and we want to see how we can make it happen, and we want to help make it happen by any means necessary. So that's my personal assignment.
And what's the title for next week's show, Sister Gidget?
It's Cain and Abel, When Will the Killing Stop? Am I My Brother's Keeper?
There you go. That's the part that I wanted to bring out in terms of the homework, Sister Gidget. I want you to please expound on that aspect and ask our listeners for next week, the part about am I my brother's keeper, that part.
I want to hear what the answers are, because when the question was asked in scripture, to me, it was a form of sarcasm. Mm. However, it's a very pertinent question. Am I my brother's keeper? And I say this all the time, but it's very meaningful to me when I say, you know, each one teach one is fine. But in order for each one to teach one, each one has to reach one.
Yes, ma'am.
And so we are not reaching for each other, if we're not embracing each other, if we're not communicating with each other effectively and in a positive manner. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, sister.
Yeah, we have a caller that wants to has a question. I don't know his number. Can you go ahead, caller?
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, this is Brother Efron. I already had a chance to speak with you previously, but I do want to touch based on the comment that was just now made, the statement on the floor, if it's possible.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. When it comes down to a topic, am I my brother's keeper? If you hear the realities of what took place during the slave plantation, if you understand the psychology that was used to do what it has done to our people, and you hear someone say, am I my brother's keeper? Do you hear them when they said, it was asked Cain and Abel, am I my brother's keeper? And one would say, no. Why would you ask me? Am I my brother's keeper? No, I'm not. That tells us realistically, if we are far more intelligent than they were at that time, if we understood from studying the historical ideal of that, then at this point, when I say that I am my brother's keeper, I'm telling you that I'm willing to risk my life to make sure that my brother has a far more better life than even I do. if I have to. Now you turn around and you ask yourself humanly, how is it possible that so many of my people at this day and this time that is so historically, biblically enhanced educationally, how can it be so many, yet you have more of this ethnic group of people doing more destruction to themselves and allowing more destruction to take place in the very homes, in the very community, in the very lives of them? So when you get it from the eyes, you get it from the head, from the ears, and you get it from the mind of a brother like me, Mr. Street Educator, you hear the raw realities of me telling you all the way from the realities of why heroin even became a big thing, from slavery to crack, from slavery to dust, from slavery all the way down to the realities of what it is to walk around with your pants hanging down, from selling you as a slave, as a man at one particular point, that he was just belittling you to be a man as he was raping and doing what he wanted to do to your wife and children, to the point where now you are honestly selling your own body, you're honestly advertising the crack of your rear end and it doesn't even bother you. When it comes down to those real realities, you hear from the mind of a brother like me telling you, realistically, that those of them that keeps on saying, yes, I am my brother's keeper, that you are a living lie. You are not your brother's keeper. You are your brother's sellout. There's no way in the world that a police officer can feel comfortable in your community doing what he wants to do in your community if he had fears, if he had respect, if he had worries about what's going to take place after he do what he do to you. And when it comes down to another ethnic group of people feeling comfortable not only to just bring guns in my community but sell guns in my community, he's selling it there because he already know what he sold to your mind. So when you recognize these T's, these ideas, when you recognize these realities, and you tell me that you are uneducated, you tell me that you are strongly active mind people, you in favor of everything that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has asked of you, when you tell me that you are doing these things, then you tell me that you can't sleep at night, brother, because we're not keeping our brothers. We are assassinating our own brothers.
Absolutely. And Brother Efron, with all due respect, you better save some of that juice for next week. I'm not playing.
Every bit of me is the life of me. This is all I live and die for, sis. I am the streets. They can't lie to me on the streets because I am the sidewalk of it. I came from the University of Streetology. I have a degree hanging on the soles of heaven. God has blessed me and made me a professor of the reality of what the black community has to offer. I give all praise to those of you that did embrace the learning of what was being taught to you, whether it was Christianity or whether it was Islam. If it taught you enough to make you so much as build the ideal of what family means, if it has you still have that right to this day, then I give all praise to God for you. I really
Thank you.
Trust me, I do.
Thank
Brothers
you so
sisters,
much.
We're down to 2 minutes right now. We're down to 2 minutes. So we got to wrap it up. Let's wrap it
Let
up.
Let me close out, Brother Caesar, because I really want to get something out there. Like I said earlier tonight, we were kind of putting the problem on the table. I'm sorry if anybody didn't get a chance to call in. But next week, listening audience, that's your week. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your solutions. We want you to call in. We're going to shut up a little bit, and we want to hear from you. Before I go, excuse me, I want to thank Brother Rakim again. I cannot say thank you enough to Brother Jason. Brother Jason, thank you for being my partner, for being my brother, for being my friend, for getting me through this. None of this would be possible without Brother Caesar, who is our engineer, who is our DJ, and we're going to give Caesar a party all week long, all weekend long this weekend. Brother Caesar, thank you ever so much for all the work you do. I call him 15 times a day, and he ain't cussed me out yet. So much love from him. Thank you, Brother Efron, for giving us a prerequisite to what we have to look forward to. And Sister Michelle, Sister Marilyn, Brother Derek, my nation building family, thank you. And I'm going to let Brother Jason close this out. Is Brother Rakim still on the phone?
I'm still here, Queen. I'm still here.
All right, well, come on, Chief Executive Officer, say something. Give us some love so we can get up out of here.
I'm going to leave real fast because
the show is over. You guys can still talk, but the show is over.
Oh, it's done. Okay.
Yeah.
It's done, too. I'll save that for next week.
Okay, that's good.
Okay.
That's good.
Brother. Thank you so much, brother.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, family.
See you. Thank you so much for the time and allowing us to be here.
Man.
Oh, you are so welcome. You.
Brother Jason, you're a real inspiration, brother. Real inspiration. Brother Ephron, if you're still listening, brother, if you're still alive, I don't know, you may be still alive, I don't know. But if he's not still alive, the brother's a real inspiration. I mean, I enjoyed and I listened to Brother Jason and Brother Ephron. I thoroughly listened to both of you brothers, and all I got to say is